And good afternoon. It is a Thursday, March the 9th, 2017, 12:15 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and we have got a great program today. A matter of fact, if you are listening to this in your car or in your house and your radio still has a knob, here's what you do. Just take that knob, pull it off, throw it away. You will not want to change the dial for the next 2 hours. I'm going to tell you what's coming up next hour really quickly. Sadly, yesterday we lost a good friend of this show, Lou Duva, legendary boxing trainer, who guested on this show several times over the years. Lou was really the Yogi Berra of the boxing world, trained Evander Holyfield and Pernell Whitaker and so many other great fighters, and was just a mainstay for so many years in the boxing industry. Lou, we will remember Lou Duva next hour by having another person on who's a frequent guest of this show, a former HBO boxing analyst, Larry Merchant. We'll remember Lou Duva and his contributions to the world of boxing. That's coming up next hour. You're not going to want to miss that. But this hour, let me just tell you how much fun this is going to be. I did not get the book until last night, and I've already read the book. And the book, let me check here, the book is over 300 pages long. That's how good this book is. Game of Thorns, the inside story of Hillary Clinton's failed campaign and Donald Trump's winning strategy. Doug Weed, New York Times best-selling author, is the author. This book will blow you away, and it's my great pleasure to welcome to these microphones Doug Weed. Doug, how are you?
Hey, Scott, thank you. Great to be with you.
Well, Doug, let me tell you, for somebody who did a daily radio show during the election, covered the Republican convention in Cleveland, did election night coverage, this book was something else.
Yeah, I didn't want to write it. I was enjoying the whole process so much. It's one of the greatest political stories of American history, in my opinion. But I was hearing all these stories that I wasn't seeing on television. I wasn't reading them in print. And I was thinking, somebody's got to write these down. And a few of them would be echoed later in a news story, but many of them I never heard of it. So I started writing the book. So I can't take credit for it because it's all these voices coming from Trump Tower and from inside Clinton's Brooklyn campaign headquarters. And it was just fascinating to me as well.
Well, Doug, that's kind of the interesting thing I wondered, because why did these people decide to speak? How did they get in contact with you? Were you in contact with them? How do we rate this as a factual book?
Well, you were saying how many pages. It's 416 pages, but there are 798 footnotes, sources. So everything's documented. There's a person or a news story behind every single statement in the book. So it's well documented, and it's just not covered. A lot of these stories that I have in Game of Thorns are on the public record, and people could find them, and or I've got a firsthand source of someone who's describing the detail. But it's not on national news, because the news is very selective. Last night on the news, one of the networks interviewed Leon Panetta as their lead story. That was news. So it's a different time.
It certainly is. Doug, I'll tell you what hooked me with this book, and I think whoever laid out this book had it right. First chapter is Election Day. Election night. And that it's fascinating. For those who don't have the book, tell us about the day of the election. What happened in Ohio that rainy day in November of 2016?
Yeah, it's it's kind of, it reminds me of an old Columbo murder mystery. You know, at the very beginning, you know who done it, but the process of getting there is just riveting. Yeah, Hillary had this thing wrapped up. She outspent him 8-1, if you count the soft money, 5-3 otherwise. She had the largest super PAC ever in American history, and they spent it, they raised it, and they spent it. She had 960,000 volunteers on the ground to turn out the vote. was a bigger turnout, voter turnout campaign than Barack Obama's spectacular effort 4 years before. She had 240 newspapers endorse her. Donald Trump had 19. she outstaffed him 5-1. She had all of academia, all of Hollywood, all of the Wall Street, the major corporations, the globalists, most of the nations of the world, $2 billion stuffed away for as a parachute in her foundation. It was pretty awesome. And he had $1 billion of earned media, and that's how he beat her.
And on Election Day, kind of take us through it. I know it's chapter one, but take it for the listening audience who doesn't have the book yet. How was the Clinton campaign feeling? How was the Trump campaign feeling? Because I tell you what I remember very vividly, because we were doing coverage that day, and I also wanted to get out and vote. But I remember turning on CNN that morning, and somebody on the morning show, a Hillary surrogate, was being interviewed, and I can't remember who it was, but she was talking about how this was going to be a great day for women and so on and so forth. And everybody thought that, I think, until 10 o'clock that night. What was going on in the campaigns that day, November 8th, 2016?
Well, a little background in Game of Thrones. Barack Obama had called over there a few months before and to the Brooklyn headquarters and said, "Hey, you're losing the evangelical Christian vote unnecessarily. You could get a piece of it if you just do ABC." And they laughed at him. Bill Clinton was furious with them for not going to Wisconsin, Ohio, Pennsylvania, the Rust Belt states, and for neglecting the Catholic vote and for purposely ridiculing Catholics in those emails and not correcting that, the Catholic spring hole scenario. He was very upset. At one point, he took his telephone and he threw it off the rooftop of the presidential pad at his library in Little Rock, Arkansas. He was so furious with him. So you have to picture that. So Bill Clinton's in the suite of rooms at the Peninsula Hotel. He's very quiet. About 9 o'clock, that's when it dawns on the Clinton team, based on their own internal numbers that they have from North Carolina, that this is a shocker. And Hillary just went berserk. I first heard it from one source that she was very angry, that there was breaking glass, that there were shouts, there were tears, there were brief moments of silence interrupted by screaming and profanity. I thought, you know, I don't know if this is true or not, but I can't go with that with one source. Then a second source standing in the hallway comes out and gives a similar description. And finally, Ed Rendell goes on national TV. He's a former governor of Pennsylvania, a Democrat. "I just left Hillary's suite, and she's very angry," he said. He didn't say heartbroken or discouraged or puzzled, or he said angry. And so it all fit. Then I went back to sources in the Clinton camp that I've known for many years that worked for her for 20, 30 years. I said, "Is this possible? Is this..." They said, "Oh yeah, that her emotions, I was described to me like a light switch. They said it can go either way. She can be in a tirade and someone will walk into the room and she'll just turn into a smiling grandmother just at the flip of the switch, or it can go the other way." And during this moment, I was told Bill Clinton was absolutely silent. He didn't touch her or make a comment, or he just sat quietly and let the storm pass.
Why did this happen? It was Hillary Clinton's campaign, and we talked about some things there that they didn't do. But why didn't they do them? Who was running this thing? We had Robbie Mook in there. We had some other top campaign officials. What was going on? What was the thought?
Well, in particular, the criticisms, the obvious criticisms, the ones that Barack Obama and Bill Clinton raised, part of it was the collusion with the media. They had the national media on their side, and they didn't feel it would be helpful to call attention. So you had this argument from Bill Clinton, Barack Obama. They're basically saying, look, Donald Trump, he gets hit with something negative, and they're knockout blows, but he comes out and he denies it, or he apologizes for it. I'm sorry, I hate this. It's not me. I'm not like that. I just hate this. And he responds to it. But these emails leaked on the Catholic Spring, which was basically an idea after she won the election, they would organize a takeover of the Catholic Church and subvert its doctrines. They would change its doctrines to fit what they wanted. This was an outrageous concept, and it came out of the leaked emails. So their answer to that was, this is the Russians. It's the Russians that have leaked these emails, but they didn't deny them. And so what Bill Clinton would like to have seen them done is get out front of this issue and say, no, we're not going to do this. This is wrong. This is absurd, and to deny it. Instead, those emails just spread from bishop to bishop, from diocese to diocese, and then the similar thing happened with evangelicals. Barack Obama was telling them, you know, the largest voter bloc on election day are the white evangelicals, Christians. That's 26%. Catholics are 22%. Hispanics, 17.6%. Blacks are 12.9%. Muslims are 1%. And you're giving him the evangelicals. At least try to get some of them. They want to vote for you. They're upset over Access Hollywood. They think Trump is lewd. Give them something. Ask for their vote. But she wouldn't do it. And on November 4th, just before the election, a bunch of Clinton celebrities got together. They wrote a song, effing this, effing that, using all kinds of Christian profanity, Jesus and other names in their video. You can imagine what would happen if they used the name Muhammad as a curse word, but here they were doing that to Christians. But 1% of the country are Muslim, 70% of the country are Christian. And this was what the Clinton campaign and their celebrities had to offer just 4 days before the vote.
Now, why does this happen? Because Hillary Clinton is married to a former president. She was a first lady. She'd been through two elections for the White House, and Bill Clinton won both of those elections pretty decisively. Barack Obama is the sitting president. He won both of his elections pretty decisively. Why wasn't the advice taken?
Yes, and not only that, but when she ran for the U.S. Senate, she worked the Republican districts in the northern part of the state of New York, and she compromised on policy and met them halfway and had an overwhelming reelection victory. She knew the value of giving something to every voter, and she's an attorney. And, you know, one of the laws of that attorneys are taught, one of the principles of being a good attorney in a trial, is to make sure you cover every point. You can't leave one or two or three points. If there's 36 points and you got 32 of them absolutely perfect, you leave the other four, and the jury are going to bring that up when they go into deliberation. So you answer everything. And that's why Obama, when the election was over, was saying, I could have won this thing, because there were boxes left unchecked. The only explanation that anybody I've ever heard come up with is hubris. And the other explanation is she feared that if she brought up these issues and tried to correct them or address them, it would call more attention to it. And the media was giving her such perfect cover. They weren't talking about this and these issues. They were talked about on the internet, word of mouth, but the national news media was not even discussing any of the details, so she felt leave well enough alone.
When it came to the polls, because I think that's what gave people a false sense of security, certainly in her campaign, what went wrong there for the first time really in history?
Yeah, well, there's many theories on that. I'm sure you've seen them in Game of Thrones. We go into them. What was rather unusual is even the night of the election, they didn't even believe their own polls when they were happening for a while. CNN, for example, held back and would not report to its viewers. All the television networks were getting their material from the same source, the Associated Press. Now, each of them had their own little fancy groups that were tweaking those numbers, and they do spot exit polls here and there to kind of give the impression that they had their own massive exit polling set up and database, but they really didn't. They were all basically, the foundation was Associated Press, and they were like a pool that provided to all the others. But CNN would get the same data Fox would get. They wouldn't call it. So this polling thing went right up to the last minute, just before he became the president-elect. By the way, we're going to call Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, bam, 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 bam. So it was partly denial. Some say it had to do with cell phones and the percentage of people use them. Some call them the Trump shy voter. I really think there's something to all of the theories, and the Trump shy voter was really one of them. I mean, here were Democrats who were white Catholics in the Rust Belt states. They had voted twice for Barack Obama. They had great sense of pride that they had done that. They'd elected an African-American as president and reelected him as president. Now they were being called racist because they wanted to have a job, and they just didn't buy it. It touched an anger. Michael Moore could see it, the comedian filmmaker. He went through Ohio. He held an event in Ohio where he kind of poked them, and the whole audience laughed. He was like, I know what you're going to do. I know what you're going to do. And he was right.
Let's go back to the beginning. Why did Donald Trump run? I remember it coming out of nowhere. I remember Jeb Bush was telegraphed. He's going to make his big announcement. And then the very next day, very minorly, coming down an escalator at Trump Tower, here comes Donald Trump. He wasn't even on the radar the month before. What happened?
Well, yeah, that's interesting. In fact, Jeb Bush outspent him 8-1 in the primary, to give you an idea. There was $1 million spent against him in TV ads the day he announced, and most people thought that was a waste of money because it was unnecessary. But it had to do with China. A long time ago, many years before, he had talked to Melania, his wife. He said, you know, I know what has to be done. I know what they're not doing, and I know why they're not doing it. And in Trump's vision, America experienced the largest transfer of wealth, the world experienced the largest transfer of wealth in history outside of the Middle East. And that was the money going from the United States to China. The trade deficit alone in 2015 was $367 billion. And the Chinese were paying with fake dollars, cheap dollar, deflated, rigged, manipulated currency. So Donald Trump saw what had to be done in his mind, in his opinion, to turn around the American economy. He saw the minority, the small group of people in academia and pharmaceuticals and different industries who were making a fortune off of China. He saw the money that flowed to the Clintons in the 1990s, the several million dollars that they had to refund. That was a big scandal, that congressional inquiry, that money coming from China to the Clintons. And he saw all this, and he thought he could fix it. And when he finally wanted to run for president this time, Melania begged him not to, said, don't. We have such a good life. We worked so hard to get here. We have a perfect life. Don't do this. And his answer to Melania was similar to his dad when his dad didn't want him to build skyscrapers in Manhattan. He said, I've got to do this. I know what to do. I know how to do this. And he even spoke in the past tense, like she was taking it away from him. I would have been so good if I could have done this. I would have been so good as president. I know what needs to be done. And she finally, in that conversation, she finally said to him, she said, well, if you have to do it, do it. But just be warned, you will win. Don't think you're going to increase your market share on your brand. You're going to win if you run. And she was right.
Well, there was a lot of talk, I remember, early on that he was doing this as a bargaining chip with NBC to get more money out of them for The Apprentice. Was that ever a thought? Was there ever a moment when he absolutely was not serious?
You know, I don't want to get in trouble, and I don't want to also preempt everything that's in Game of Thrones. I don't know if you've read it yet, but everything is in play. Everything was in play, and everything is in play. This is a businessman, and everything is out on the table. There's this, there's that, there's number 26 here, and everything was considered. But he saw numbers that a lot of people didn't see. You know, there's that great quote from Schopenhauer, I think it is, that a talent is hitting a target no one else can hit. Genius is hitting a target that no one else can see. And he had some of those numbers. A good example of that is the evangelical Christian vote, which you would never, ever associate with profane, outrageous, brash New York Donald Trump. But he's sitting in Trump Tower one day. He's feeling kind of blue. He loved Norman Vincent Peale, who was at the Presbyterian Church on Fifth Avenue right down the street from him, but he died, and he was a very positive preacher. He's watching TV, and he sees this sexy blonde televangelist named Paula White. She's very positive. He calls her up afterwards. He says, "Gosh, you're terrific. You are terrific. Can I fly you up here?" Flies her up to New York. And she walks him through the evangelical movement, who they are, who the leaders are, how they think, what the subgroups are, how to reach them. She gives him the whole skinny. He admits to her, he confesses to her, you know, I've been married three times. She says back to him, "Me too." So he meets an evangelical Christian who's not judgmental towards him, and who does what he likes to do, which is learn the neighborhood. He'd rent a property, walk the neighborhood for years before he'd build a building. And that's what he did with some of these voter blocks. He understood them in a way that most politicians didn't understand them.
Before he ever got to the to Hillary Clinton, there were 17 people in these Republican debates and primaries. What were the big guns thinking, the front runners, Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz? What were their campaigns thinking once the debates got underway and Donald Trump was leading in the polls and had been for quite a while?
They knew that he would collapse. They knew he would collapse, and they were positioning to how they could survive his collapse, recapture some of his support, and refashion it for a general election run. So that was everybody's take. The early take was, do we take him on because he counterpunches and gets really nasty and he does have a following, which we don't want to lose? So that was part of the consideration. I know, because I was a senior advisor at that time to Rand Paul, and it was debated heavily. Do we take him on in this debate? Or do we let his wrath just flow over us and he's going to implode anyway? So that was the thinking. They were wrong. I was wrong. We were all wrong. I once called over to Trump Tower when I started writing the book. I said, "You guys are off message." They said, "No, we're not." I said, "Yes, you are. He just did this tweet. This is ridiculous." And they said, "You don't know the message." I said, "Okay, give me the message." They said, "The message is, number one, make America great again, jobs, jobs, jobs. And number two, the message is, I'm not a politician. And all these rough edges you see are reassuring to people who don't want another politician."
And when it started to look like it was not going to happen for Jeb Bush, South Carolina, what was the thinking then? There was apparently some... I guess, interplay here with the Clintons. It's an interesting story.
Yeah, that's a fascinating story. There was collusion between the Clintons and the Trumps. There was estrangement for many years. When I would talk with 41 and talk with 43, they were not very impressed with Bill Clinton and his affairs and the scandals. They were themselves scandalized by it. But after the tsunami in the South Pacific, when Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush got together to help raise money for survivors, they developed a really close friendship. So at first there was collusion between the Clintons and the Bushes. They had the same donors. They had the same group of people advising them as they started out in their campaigns. And the Clintons signaled to the Bushes, "Don't worry about Donald Trump. there's a silver bullet out there. He's not going to survive. He will be out of the running in the primaries. Don't worry. And then Jeb Bush had this massive, unbelievable opposition research beyond anything your mind can comprehend. If you could imagine, you've got a ton of money to work with. You've got the best in intelligence, the best private detectives. You've got the best PR firms in the country working for you to solve these little problems and piece together this composite of who Donald Trump is, all his business deals, all you've accountants. You've got all of this working for you, and it was massive, and they couldn't find the silver bullet. So they worked their way back to the Clintons, saying, hey, can you help us a little bit with and by this time, the Clintons are saying, are you kidding me? If you haven't found it, we're not going to give it to you because we've changed our minds. We think Donald Trump is a better opponent for the general election. So they worked together, and then in the end, they betrayed each other.
Now, when Donald Trump became the candidate, when he wiped everybody else out, and Hillary was still in a little primary battle there with Bernie, when Hillary knew it was going to be Trump, what was the feeling at the Clinton campaign at that point?
Absolute elation. They had the silver bullet. They knew there was this negative story out there that would take him out. They knew that executives at the news media, and by the way, in Game of Thrones, there's footnotes and names and references for people to follow and track these stories because they are just fascinating stories. But they knew that the story was coming, and there was some there still is a little bit of mystery whether they were the silver bullet was the British thing or it was the Access Hollywood thing. But in any case, the Access Hollywood thing, regardless of which it was, it overtook the British thing, and that became the knockout blow.
That being said, when those things came out, especially the Access Hollywood thing, I'll never forget that weekend. Tape came out on a Friday, 2 days before the debate, and it was just one of the most amazing political weekends ever. What was going on? I remember nobody would come out of Trump Tower. All the media was down on the doorstep. The Clinton campaign wasn't saying much. What was going on inside of Trump Tower the weekend of the Access Hollywood tape?
Well, it was a complete collapse. I mean, the numbers showed Hillary up 14 points in October. The last time that had ever happened in American history was when Ronald Reagan beat Walter Mondale for re-election in 1984. He went into October 14 points up, and he carried every state in the Union except Minnesota. So it was quite clear that she would not only win, she was going to win in a historic landslide. And there was some voter remorse and support remorse towards Trump. Similar to what happened to Bill Clinton when he lied about Monica Lewinsky, and that became apparent. Some of his closest friends, including Al Gore, were horrified by it. So Donald Trump was all alone. And in that period, Reince Priebus stepped up. So did the family, the children. His sister said, you've got to answer. You've got to get in there, Donald, and answer. His wife stuck with him. And there was a brief period where he wondered, can we pass this thing on to Pence? Everybody seems to love my choice of Pence. Can he pick it up and carry it on? And the answer back, primarily from Reince Priebus and others, was it's non-transferable. I mean, we can't do it. These people supported you. They're from the rallies, your strongest supporters. It's partly a personality cult. Part of it is they sense what's going on with China and jobs and the corruption in the American economy, and you're their person. So Trump was very discouraged. There's a dispute about this. There's another source in Trump Tower that tells me Trump was just playing a game. He was testing them. But boy, looks to me like for a period there, he was bleeding and he was done.
There was a point during this entire election when Trump decided or was thinking pretty seriously about getting out. When did that happen?
Yeah, that was right after Access Hollywood. That he, and it was, there's no way, he didn't want to hurt all these people that counted on him and supported him, that came up to him and looked him in the eye and, are you real? And people that understood. Trump saw that we were experiencing the largest transfer of wealth in the history of the world outside of the Middle East, and that was wealth going from the United States to China. And in the process, a tiny percentage of people in academia, in pharmaceuticals, in key industries were making a fortune. They were making millions of dollars, but the country was getting screwed. $367 billion trade deficit, and all debts paid off with manipulated currency. He saw this very clearly as the key to the economic collapse in America, the downfall. Three presidents, Clinton, Bush, and Obama, all three greasing the skids for China. In fact, today, much of the hoopla you see about Russia, you see people pushing us into conflict. They want us to go to war with Russia or contend with Russia. A lot of that is to keep us from dealing with China, to protect their own financial interests, the money they're making in the deals with China. So Trump saw that if he didn't stay in there, this would be lost. And in his mind, the country would never be the same again if it doesn't stand up quickly and stop this flow, this bleeding, this economic bleeding.
You know, as I said, I attended the Republican convention. It was different. There was a different feeling there than I've really ever felt any other place. It was kind of nobody knew where to go. It was just a little confusing. The Democratic convention seemed to have a big speaker every night, Biden, President Obama, President Clinton, and having Hillary walk out as a surprise the night before at the end of President Obama's speech. What was the feeling during the conventions?
Well, the Trump campaign was scrambling for its life. The wolves were out. It was pretty much over. But there was a chance. That's why you saw the Mitt Romney speech at the last minute. Trump didn't have experience as a politician. He didn't have a ground game. So what happens when you get chosen as a delegate to this convention, let's say you get the state chairman calls you up and says, hey, buddy, you know, I've enjoyed your radio show, and would you like to be a delegate to the convention this year? And you say, well, I guess so. How does that work? Well, you just let me guide you now. So he guides you. He has you go to a few precinct meetings and make an appearance there and just sit quietly and listen to 10 or 15 people talk about politics. And then he puts your name on a list, and you get on a list that's voted on at the congressional level, and he tells his people to vote for you in the congressional district, and then it goes to state, and if you make it all the way, you end up on the state delegation. Now, let's say Trump carries your state. So technically, according to the state laws, you have to vote for Trump on the first ballot. On the second ballot, you're free. Who are you going to vote for? You're going to vote for the guy who walked you through that process, who got you on there. And he says, can I count on your vote? You say, absolutely. They picked up your airline fare. You got the Godiva chocolate on your pillow every night. You got some nice meals, all the booze you want to drink. So you're going to vote for him. Well, those foot soldiers were not Donald Trump people. They were people that had been brought in by Mitt Romney 4 years before and 8 years before. Some of them belonged to Rubio. They belonged to Ted Cruz. And Trump had not recruited at the precinct level. So that's why the convention, it was so vulnerable. It was only that the establishment began to realize if we dump Trump or try to dump Trump, we're destined to hurt ourselves. There's no way we can give this to Romney or anybody else. So, yes, there were. That's why they brought in Paul Manafort. That was his skill set, and he was able to cut some deals and go into a group like yours and say, hey, I'll double your Godiva chocolates, plus we're going to do this, we're going to do that, but we want you to stick with us beyond the first ballot.
The debates. The first debate was watched by more people than any other presidential debate in television history. What was the feeling inside the campaigns during the debates?
tremendous amount of effort went into preparation for the debates. They all had shills for all the other candidates and teams assigned to those shills to prep them, large loose-leaf notebooks that would have every position of every candidate on, from honeybee subsidies to whatever. They had comedians drawing up one-liners. They had the good campaigns had full dress rehearsals. The bad campaigns didn't. But the good campaigns, they wanted the candidate, Jeb Bush, for example, they wanted him to feel what it's like to stand up there with all these other people and not being able to talk, and to let him actually feel what it's like when he's only got two or three chances to talk, what he better say. And the Trump campaign spent, ironically, far less time on practice sessions, and he ended up coming out better. He just sucked all the oxygen out of the room. I remember calling over there saying to somebody, you're off message. They said, no, we're not. We're on message. You don't know the message. I said, okay, well, tell me. What's the message? They said, well, it's make America great again. And the second message is, I'm not a politician. That was the message. So when he was off message, he was really on message.
By the time we got to the fall, and it was he and Hillary, what was the feeling around those debates?
Well, you have to remember the second debate happened right after Access Hollywood. So he only had one debate. And the feeling was, in the first debate, they were feeling pretty good. Almost all the commentary said that she had won the debate. But what they liked and what they knew is that the undecided voters in those seven toss-up states, they were polled and asked what was the most important issue, and their answer was the economy. Most of them turned it off after the first 20 minutes, and most people felt that Donald Trump had won the first 20 minutes when they talked about the economy and he got his points about China across. So they felt that was a win for them, for their purpose. Did it help win them votes with African Americans? No. Or Muslims? No. But it did with the undecided voters in those seven toss-up states. So they were pretty happy, even though the networks called it for Hillary Clinton. The second debate happened only a day or two after the Access Hollywood, and he was like a bull in the ring, and they're sticking swords in him. He was bleeding. He had Anderson Cooper on one side and Martha Raddatz on the other, and after they kind of bled him a little bit over Access Hollywood, they turned him over to Hillary, and they said, you have a comment on this? And her comment was, well, you know, I've debated many candidates, and this is the first time I've actually faced a candidate that isn't even qualified to be president of the United States. So they worked him over. He was like a little boy with the principal and the assistant principal and his mama, and he was bleeding. But if you'll remember, before that debate was over, he pulled his own version of Lloyd Benson. I know Abraham Lincoln. He's a friend of mine. And you, Hillary Clinton, are no Abraham Lincoln. And that... it was amazing that he's landed on his feet in that debate.
Another interesting thing that everybody harkens back to in this election is FBI Director Comey. Now, this starts in July when he comes out and says they're not going to prosecute Hillary, but she was extremely careless. And then here he comes again 11 days before the election. Why did this happen?
Wow, that is that is very hard to explain in 2 minutes, because that's a very important thesis in Game of Thrones, the story of the election. But the Clintons and the FBI faced off each other for 27 years. There was a 27-year war between the FBI and the Clintons, and it continued right up to that moment when Jim Comey made his decision. And again, whether it's the FALN terrorists, whether it was the Mark Rich pardon, no matter what the scandal was, again and again, Jim Comey when he served in the district attorney's office, in the attorney's office, rather, of New York State, when he served in the Justice Department and was asked to actually investigate the Mark Rich pardon and whether there was corruption. Again and again, Jim Comey would come to the conclusion, they're guilty, but I can't prove it.
I understand. I'm not sure that he should have made the commentary back in July. During an election, that's debatable. But 11 days before the election, when he had not even seen the laptop yet, and come to find out there was nothing on there, why did he do that? And how bad did that hurt Hillary Clinton?
Well, there was a big war on inside the FBI. I mean, the FALN blew up the FBI headquarters in New York, in Manhattan. And Bill Clinton pardoned them, as the New York Times said, as a gift to Hillary when she ran for the Senate. And Mark Rich was on the top 10 most wanted list of the FBI. The FBI, there were people in the FBI who were sick at how their agency had been compromised and destroyed by the Clintons over the years and corrupted by the Clintons. So you have that working its way. I mean, when Sally Perdue gave her testimony, she had an eyewitness sitting next to her when Democrat officials came out and offered her a job for silence. She, unknowns to the Democrat official, she had a witness sitting on a bar stool right next to the table who heard it, who then went into the FBI offices and gave an affidavit and confirmed everything Sally Perdue had heard. So you have all these stories, all these investigations, 27 years of them in the bloodstream of the FBI, and then you've got the guy who takes the investigation of her emails, and his wife gets $400,000-$500,000 donation running for as a Democrat for the state Senate in Virginia from Terry McAuliffe, who was the governor of Virginia, who was the finance chairman for the Clinton reelection campaign, and he's the guy that's heading up the investigation. So when you had Niglap Singh, who was at the center of Chinagate, who disappeared and went to China after wiring $1 million to a cook in a Little Rock, Arkansas Chinese restaurant who turned over $400,000 to the Clintons, who the FBI investigated then, congressional inquiry, he's forced to give it back. That's all in the Washington Post, New York Times. That's an open story, your people. He shows up on the streets of New York City in the middle of the Trump-Clinton election. The FBI arrest him again. They go to his hotel room. He's got suitcases full of cash. You talk about the Russians influencing the election. So you got FBI officers in New York wanting to follow this wherever it goes. You got the FBI in Washington saying, are you kidding me? She's going to be our boss in 2 months. She will be our boss. Leave it alone. And so you have all of this raging inside poor Jim Comey, and he has to somehow hold his agency together and reassure them that no one's above the law. And so he does the best he can.
Doug, I have three questions I want to get in really quick here. And there were reports that President Obama called Hillary Clinton the night of the election and asked her to concede. What happened on that phone call?
Yeah. Even before the phone call, she had numbers, some of their own numbers from North Carolina, let them see what was going to happen. And she went, she lost it. She lost her temper. That's even public. Ed Rendell, the governor of Pennsylvania, publicly on TV said, I just left the Peninsula Hotel, and Secretary Clinton is very angry, he said. But she lost it. There was shattering glass. There were tears. There was cursing. There was, it was not a pleasant moment. I had multiple sources. They said Bill Clinton was absolutely stoic. He didn't touch her or embrace her or open his mouth. He just sat there. And, of course, he had warned. It was a very disturbing, a very sad, and an angry and profane moment for Hillary Clinton.
And did the President Obama, did he call?
Yes, I am told that he did. that he did make the call. But I have to say there were multiple calls he had made to Brooklyn too, to the that went unreported, that I'm told by an intern who was there when he called in. And I was told that after the election was over, it was why he was so, I don't know how to describe it, when he publicly said, I could have won this. That struck people as rather cocky and rather mean-spirited. But it's because he was so frustrated that there were so many boxes left unchecked.
Two quick questions here. In your research and you're working this book, is there collusion between Donald Trump and Russia?
Well, you know, I keep going back. The short answer is no. I do qui bono, who benefits. Atwater taught me that. Lee Atwater said, you always know who leaked the story because of who it benefits. Forget what the sleight of hand when they say a source said, and former this, now this. Don't let them fool you. Just answer the question, qui bono. And it's hard to believe that the Russians, who actually gave money to Hillary Clinton's foundation and got the Silicon Valley deal in return, got the uranium deal in return, it's pretty far-fetched that they wanted to elect Donald Trump, and he's their puppet, and the first thing they have him do is raise military spending.
Well, and Doug,
I find it's a nice narrative for the news media, but it's not very logical.
And Doug, the final question I have for you is, and it's the only criticism I've heard, but I've heard people say that you worked for Rand Paul in this campaign, you've been with Lee Atwater, who was with the Bushes, Bush number one, that of course this book is not going to be written in any positive way for Hillary Clinton, and that there's going to be a slant toward the Republican because there is not a love of Hillary Clinton on your behalf, and maybe it's not the most accurate depiction of what happened. What do you say to those people?
Well, you know, my heart goes out to Hillary Clinton, and I'm as objective as I can be. And there are 798 footnotes and sources for everything written there. But I am a bit of a rebel. And in my research, I found that 126 raters for the presidential campaigns, the cat is out of the bag. They're to the left. You can Google them yourself. Start with Howard K. Smith, the first one. Go right down the list. Because of the internet, there is no longer even a pretense. They're all to the left. So do I discount everything that everybody on the left says? No, I think the New York Times is my biggest source in the book, and the Washington Post is second. But yes, people have their political persuasions. As a presidential historian, I'm the only room that is even a Republican. They're all to the left. So I think all of us have a right to speak, and I wish no harm to Hillary Clinton. There are parts of my story very disturbing and heartbreaking to see her lose this chance, but I wanted to tell it all, and I certainly didn't hide any of the warts that Donald Trump has or Hillary Clinton.
Game of Thorns, the inside story of Hillary Clinton's failed campaign and Donald Trump's winning strategy. Doug Weed is the author. Doug, this has been fascinating. I hope you come back in the future because lots more to talk about for sure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug. Bye-bye.
Thank you, sir.
We are going to take a short break, come back with a Lou Duva tribute and Terry Tackett, some comments on what he just heard. Stay tuned to WWGH Radio.
407-1163. Website